Black Clock Audio Tales is a daily podcast. This is one of our supplemental episodes about Mary Shelley. Supplemental episode number 7, Mary Shelley in the Gothic Tradition, by Andrew Grace. Thank you for joining us once again. If you like these kinds of shows, remember to rate, review, and subscribe to Black Clock Audio Tales. Give us a review, tell your friends about it, and message us, maybe find out where to get some stickers. Stick a sticker on your skateboard, or your trapper keeper, or your yoga mat, or your water bottle, or your banjo case. Anyway, this episode is also brought to you by BunnySlippers.com. Get their cool Cthulhu slippers, their dino sound slippers, their zombie slippers. They got animal slippers. They got cool slippers. BunnySlippers.com. Check them out. If you want to, you can always check out our Cthulhu show, which is at the end of the month, last Tuesday of every month. We have a show dealing with the Cthulhu mythos. This month we'll be dealing with the Migo, Yawgoth, and Zach A. Ferguson talking about silent film, which I said, hey, you want to be on the show? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, let's talk about some stuff. And he talked about silent film. Fritz Lang in particular. I have too. So, hey, it works for the show. All right. We're going to be talking to Andrew Grace. Thank you so much for listening to Black Clock Audio Tales. Look for us online, everywhere. Black Clock Audio Tales, pgttcm.com, Badger's Drift Studio, beautiful North Portland. Black Clock Audio Tales starts now. Andrew Grace, here's the mic.
Okay, I'm Andrew Grace. I have a PhD from the University of Oregon in English Literature, where I studied Victorian Gothic fiction. In particular, I wrote my dissertation about the relationship between the Gothic tradition and the rise of empirical sciences as a profession. I discussed Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus by Mary Shelley, in one of my chapters. And one of the things that I was particularly concerned about when I analyzed that text was how it challenged our understanding of narration and sensory perception, so that we have within the text three different narrators. We have Robert Walton, a scientist and explorer attempting to cross the Arctic, who is writing the text back to his sister in England. We have Frankenstein, the doctor and scientist who creates the creature that is the most famous result of the novel. And we have the creature himself, who narrates some of his experiences. And this layers of narration in which Robert Walton tells us much of the story, but turns over the narration to Frankenstein and turns over the narration to Frankenstein's creature, makes it very difficult to get a sense of whose interpretation of events is correct. And this is definitely not a novel where you can ever say there's something simple or something direct, some message that the novel is conveying to us, whether that's about science or about gender relations. One of the common things that people try to talk about with the novel is the idea that men are pushing women out of the story, trying to create other men without women's involvement, for example. And that's certainly an issue. There's just nothing simple about it in the novel, because none of the stories, none of the messages are simple. And the novel fits into the Gothic tradition because it builds on the Gothic tradition's interest in sensory perception and in interpretation and in telling stories, where throughout the 18th century, from the inception of the Gothic tradition in the middle of the 18th century to the height of the Gothic tradition in the late 18th century with Anne Radcliffe's novels, the Gothic tradition and Gothic stories were really interested in how people encountered phenomenal situations, extraordinary situations, and tried to understand them and tried to make sense of them. Takes that interest in people trying to understand their extraordinary situations and flips it on its head. So that in Frankenstein, you have characters like Sir Walton, who is an Arctic explorer. He's interested in extraordinary things. He's trying to find a quicker passage around the world. You have Frankenstein, Victor Frankenstein, who is a scientist who's interested in the very essence of life and what it means to be alive and how we could create life. And he successfully creates life. And you have Frankenstein's creature, this incredibly articulate and intelligent creature that studies everything and learns everything and discovers its own interests. So you have these extraordinary characters who are very different from the common Gothic protagonist, who is much more of a naive, maybe exceptionally virtuous, but not exceptionally intelligent young woman who encounters extraordinary things. So we go from a character who is ordinary but encounters exceptional things to characters who are themselves extraordinary. Whether you are one of Radcliffe's ordinary gentlewomen or Mary Shelley's extraordinary scientists, they all run up against the same problem, which is, how do I understand what my senses are telling me? How do I understand the world around me? And that's really where Gothic terror comes from. Gothic terror comes from the idea that we wouldn't understand the world around us, that there would be things that are beyond our experiences, that are beyond what we have been told we're going to encounter, and when we encounter them, what do we do? So for an Anne Radcliffe protagonist, that's, I thought I saw a ghost, and the ghost is actually just a pirate in a bedsheet.
Yeah.
And for one of Mary Shelley's protagonists, that's, I brought this creature to life after constructing it from the parts of dead people. So those are different scenarios, but it's the same essential problem, which is I don't know what to do. I don't have a knowledge base for this. And so that for me, when I read it as a 19-year-old in college for the first time, and I read Frankenstein, and I kind of knew what Frankenstein's creature was, the most surprising thing for me was the moment where I'm reading, oh, okay, Frankenstein is constructing a person out of the parts of dead people. Okay, I knew that because I've heard of Frankenstein. And that he brings the creature to life and immediately freaks out and runs away and hides. Because what I had grown up with is some image, and I don't even know where it came from, of Frankenstein shouting, "It's alive!"
Yeah.
Right? Like, I thought that was a thing, but it's like, no. He doesn't say that. He runs away. He's terrified by what he's done. Because he didn't have any basis for understanding what was going to happen. And then that's the same thing with the creature. The creature, upon being forsaken by its creator, also runs away and hides in the woods. And we later get some understanding of what he does in the woods, where he tries to understand his own senses. And at first, his senses are blurred. He can't separate sight from sound, from smell, from touch. And he kind of tells us about that, which is really interesting. And that, blurring of the senses, that failure to understand them, leads into his sort of later actions, or at least his excuses for his later actions, where he sort of inadvertently kills a child, according to the creature. But it's all of a piece with this literary tradition of trying as a writer to explain things to an audience, but also recognizing that the audience might not understand those things. And so creating a protagonist who does not understand those things, so that the audience and the protagonist are in the same situation. And this is really, in my view, the core of the Gothic tradition, is to put the audience and the protagonist in a similar situation of feeling tension, of feeling fear, because they don't know what's happening. And you could think of it as different to something like a detective story, where the detective is always removed from the audience, and we're often given a different point of view character. So Watson is often our point of view character. We know what Watson knows, but we don't know what Sherlock knows. And Sherlock gets to understand things and explain them to us. But within the Gothic novel, we don't have a Sherlock. We're like all just Watson all the time. Huh. Super confused. And in Frankenstein, everybody's like Sherlock level genius, but still Watson level confused. And that's why critics never really know what to do with Frankenstein.
All right.
Which is where I run into problems with it.
That's a fair assessment. I've been talking to quite a few people who are writers and scholars and game designers talking about Frankenstein, and there are certain walls that Frankenstein has, a certain, like, not only kind of like a certain, like, level of admittance, it's like you must be able to understand this much before you can enter Frankenstein, but Frankenstein...
That's very true.
Frankenstein...
You must be this tall as a literary scholar before you can enter.
Yeah, but you also must be willing to deal with this kind of level of literary bullshit that Shelley and Melville and other greats are going to throw at you, and you just have to, like, bat it away and be like, it's early literature, I'm going to put up with this because there is more of a story here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, and I think that's really part of the challenge of the novel, is that there are so many things that you want to talk about in a more simplified way.
Yeah.
Like, you could get so excited to talk about Frankenstein as the first science fiction novel. Like, the first novel really driven by one big scientific theory related to what animates life. And you could just talk about it as a scientific novel, but then you kind of have to ignore what's going on at the narrative level.
Yeah.
You have to ignore that we don't know who to trust. Or, you know, what is the relationship between the stories that each of these characters are giving us. And I just think that, like, it is definitely a novel. As someone who has read a lot of literary essays about the novel, it's a novel that a lot of people take to their own pet place. It's open to being interpreted in such a wide array of ways that people will be like, definitely what I think is supported by the novel.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a little unfortunate when, if you really open yourself up to the full complexity of the novel and the uncertainty of the novel, it doesn't support a lot of clear ideas. It just supports the idea that our senses and our experiences are complex and uncertain. Which, granted, is not a super satisfying message to take away from a novel. Oh, great, life is difficult. Thanks, novel. I really need a clarification on that point.
Okay, so last time we talked about how Dracula would have done in The Great Gatsby, in the world of The Great Gatsby, which you and I have talked in length on the show, outside of the show, Gatsby. How do you think Victor Frankenstein would have done within Gatsby's crew? He's a young, smart, bright thing.
Yeah, so I think Frankenstein would do really well in Gatsby's crew, because he is old moneyed, right? He has inherited his wealth. I mean, his wealth is possibly even older than Tom Buchanan's. It is older than Ball's. So he could fit in with the old money crowd. And he shares Tom Buchanan's penchant for pseudoscience. And on the other hand, he could kind of fit in with a new money crowd. Like, he's interested in new things. He's interested in new ideas. And he totally lacks human empathy, which would help him fit in with both crowds. So I think that he would be one of those people who can just, like, surf above it all. He could go to all the parties. He could kind of show up at the funeral.
For multiple reasons.
Yeah.
Is the brain okay?
It's like, I see that the bullet went through the heart. I don't need that. I think he would do really well. You know, like I said, Dracula would do really well because no one's paying attention.
Yeah. Yeah, Dracula would do very well as a predatory figure.
Yeah, because, like, no one's trying, you know. Whereas I think Frankenstein would do well because he could get just the level of attention he needs if he really tried.
Yeah.
You know, like, Tom Buchanan, Daisy Buchanan, they'd be kind of like, yes, we will listen to you, crazy man, because you are part of our social class.
Drew, thank you again, Andrew Grace, for coming on the show and talking Frankenstein. And yeah, we'll have you on the show sometime in the future, I'm sure, to talk about something.
Yeah, we'll bring you on to talk about Jane Eyre, which I know way better than Frankenstein.
Oh, sure, yeah. No, we'll get you on.
Yeah, when were you thinking of doing Jane Eyre?
Thank you once again to Andrew Grace for being a guest talking about Frankenstein and his creature, Mary Shelley, the Gothic tradition. And yeah, we'll be doing Jane Eyre, I believe, in September, just in time for everyone to go back to school and crib stuff off of a podcast for their book reports. Remember, Blacklock Audio Tales, number one source for not having to read the book. Hey, if you wrote a report that you just like listen to stuff that we talk about in the supplemental parts, put that in your 5-star review. Teachers, ignore that part. Thank you, everyone. This has been Black Clock Audio Tales, and back to next episode of The Last Man by Mary Shelley. Thank you so much, and thank you once again for listening to Black Clock Audio Tales, available wherever you find your podcasts. And also, hey, check us out on Podbean, Apple Podcasts, and Stitcher. Burp-a-doo. Later.